welcome to the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Karen Richardson, author of Harvesting the American Dream, a novel based on the life of Ernest Gallo, who co-founded the E&J Gallo Winery in Modesto, California in 1933. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
We're excited to chat about Ernest Gallo because no one really knows a lot about him because we just know the E in the E&J. So it'll be fun to find out what made him tick. Mm-hmm. So the first thing I was thinking about was, what do you think were the burning questions or the issues of his era? What was he dealing with in his youth that were things he would overcome to create this winery?
Okay. Well, he had a very complicated childhood, and not an easy childhood. He had an abusive father, physically, emotionally abusive, mental illness in the family, a lot of tragedy, grew up moving from place to place, you know, as the family tried to find their way, grew up during the Depression, and founded the wine company just at the end of Prohibition.
Well, that was good timing.
Yes, it was, yeah.
So why do we think in today's world he matters?
I think he, not single-handedly, but he changed the whole wine business. When he was born in 1909, and when he grew up, wine was associated with immigrants in a very negative way.
How weird, because today, of course, wine is everybody's cool thing.
Right, right. And at the time, it was, you know, Italians were discriminated against, Eastern Europeans, Germans. That was who drank wine, and they drank sweet wine.
Oh, how fun. I never thought about that.
Yeah. And, you know, alcohol was, hard liquor was popular, and beer somewhat. But wine was an afterthought. And I think he was somewhat inspired by Procter & Gamble and Coca-Cola and thought, you know, he wanted to put a bottle of wine on every dinner table.
I like that.
Yeah, me too.
How interesting. So in a way, that's what makes Americans interested in wine today.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. And built up a business that, at least in California, is quite large.
Yeah, worldwide. It's one of the biggest wine companies in the world.
I had no idea.
And they own, over time, they bought other wineries and other labels. And right now, I think it's either 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 of every bottle of wine sold in the U.S. is a Gallo wine.
I had no idea, but with all the different names then.
Yes, exactly.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And that's a funny story, Two Buck Chuck from Trader Joe's
right.
is actually his nephew started that company.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, and they've sold quite a lot.
Yeah, the Franzias, which is also like a big box wine. Right. His wife, her maiden name was Franzia.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, they do have the fingers and everything.
Yes, yes.
Ha, how fun. Well, does that mean they got any good reviews of their wines? I mean, we have a bad thought about boxed wine, but do they have good reviews?
Right. I mean, that's the thing that was interesting to me is Gallo is not associated with wine. Yeah, I mean, good quality wine. And, you know, it's almost the brunt of jokes about wine. But we wouldn't be drinking the wines we are today without Gallo.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
So we owe him that much.
We do. We do.
That's interesting. How cool is that? It'll make me think differently when I have Two Buck Chuck at another fundraiser.
Right, yes.
How fun. So thinking about that and thinking about our attitude sort of against the kinds of wines he would be known for with his name, what was your impression before you started researching him?
Well, the early research I did, there wasn't a lot of material about him. He was a very private person, did very few interviews. The New York Times obituary described him as, I think, secretive, somber, and humorless.
Oh, how sad.
And Gallo, what I learned early on too, Ripple, Thunderbird, Boone's Farm were all Gallo products.
I had no idea.
So, you know, I started off thinking, how am I going to write? He sounds very unlikable, you know?
Sad.
And how am I going to make this work? But I think he was mischaracterized and misjudged. And once you understand more about how he grew up, and what he had to deal with, you can understand why he might be secretive or reclusive from the, you know.
So then where did you find material about him?
Most of it came from, he had written with his brother Julio, they had written a biography which covered their whole lives from early childhood through Julio's death anyway.
Oh, wow.
And then I found University of California was very involved in early wine research in viticulture through UC Davis and UC Berkeley. And they had done a series, an oral series, where they interviewed important people in the wine business. So he died in 2007, and you would think there would be plenty of video and archival footage, and nothing. I found one speech he gave at a function up in Northern California, and that was it. No television interviews, very few photographs of him.
Well, then what did you find in the research? What were the talents he brought to making this company?
I think he was a perfectionist, and he was relentless and felt like no one could do it as well as he could or work as hard as well as he could. And when he started off, wine was actually a commodity. It was no different from grapes or soybeans or corn. It wasn't a it wasn't a brand.
Oh.
And it was shipped in tanker cars by train, by freight train. And it would pull up at the distributor who had the bottling plant, and they would bottle the wine and put a different label, you know, their own label on it. So you could go to any part of the country and drink the same wine, but it would be called something different wherever you went.
Silly.
And there was no demarcation of year or what kind of grape. It was just, it was either red or white, and most of it was sweet. And I think he saw the potential in creating a brand, one of the first national brands, and marketing it. And he created a whole vertically integrated company where they oversaw not only the growing of the grapes, the production of the grapes, transportation, the bottling, the marketing.
That's a lot for one immigrant kid to come up
right,
with.
Right, yeah, yeah.
That's so interesting. I can't imagine a giant tanker truck full of wine rumbling down the
right,
road.
Right. And then what happened with Prohibition, because there were a lot of wineries in California before Prohibition. It was used, again, drunk by immigrants and used in the sacrament and also for medicinal purposes. Doctors yeah. would prescribe tonic. During Prohibition, the manufacture and sale of wine was illegal, but not the production. So each household could make 200 gallons of wine for their own use. So suddenly across the country, Dad was putting a little grape press in his basement, and instead of shipping the wine in tanker cars, they were shipping grapes across country, which, you know, was more difficult because they have a shelf life. They would ferment and rot along the way, and it was difficult. But when Ernest Gallo was, I think he was maybe 16, like I said earlier, his father was a very difficult person and had had trouble in Chicago selling grapes.
Oh.
And so when Ernest was 16, he convinced his father to let him to go to Chicago. And he got permission from his teachers to take a couple weeks off of school.
To go sell wine. That's funny.
And he was on the rail yards in Chicago selling grapes.
What was your favorite scene that you wrote? Because you have to, it's a novel, so we're historically, it's a historic novel, so we're telling the story with a little bit of a literary bent. So what was a scene you really enjoyed writing?
There were probably two scenes, and they were hardly even scenes. They were very small little bits that I put in there that I felt like said a lot about Ernest Gallo and about people and perception and personality. He was raised by his grandparents at an early age. His parents lived in, at the time, in Oakland, and they were running a boarding house. And Ernest was one or 2 years old, and then she had Julio just a year later. So Ernest was sent to live with his grandparents, his maternal grandparents, so the parents could run the pension, the saloon, and take care of Julio. And considering how difficult his childhood was, to me that time with his grandparents were probably his happiest, most carefree memories. And his grandfather had come over from northern Italy on a boat, and the scene I wrote is they're going to church. His grandfather's bringing the wine to the priest. And Ernest says, tell me another story, tell me a story. So he tells him the story of his voyage over on the ship. And he, you know, is talking to a five-year-old and makes it like this crazy adventure with pirates and all this loot and all this stuff. And then fast forward to, I don't know, when he's an adult or in his 20s or teens, maybe he was in his teens at that time. And I wrote a scene where his father, who had also come over from northern Italy on a similar boat, you know, probably in the bowels of the ship with people, you know, squashed together under, you know, difficult circumstances, talks about how miserable the journey was and how horrible it was and what he went through for his sons to have a better life. And it was just fun for me thinking about how two people could look at the same situation.
It's all about perspective.
Yeah.
Have fun. And giving him the perspective of which way to look at the world.
Right. And I think to do what he did, he had to be an optimist.
So he got that from his grandfather.
Yeah, I would think.
So does that mean you think that his grandfather was his mentor in life?
I don't know that he had. I mean, his grandfather, he was with him for a very early age, and his grandfather wasn't healthy. And when he was, I think around 7, he moved back with his parents, and I don't think he saw his grandfather much after that. But I think he had kind of an anti-mentor, if that's a term,
that's
in
a
his father.
Name.
I think he saw what he didn't want to be and the mistakes he didn't want to make. His father was a farmer and grew grapes and vegetables. And at one point, Ernest said that he planted his father planted everything at the wrong time in the wrong place and just had bad luck as a farmer. Where Ernest's approach to growing grapes and the rest of the businesses he built was very meticulous, and he did a lot of research. I think if he met anyone who knew more about something than he did, he sought their wisdom and advice. When Ernest and Julio started the company, they bought all the equipment, were ready to go, and then it occurred to them that they really didn't know how to make wine. They knew how to make it, you know, as a backyard operation for the family, but they didn't know how to produce thousands of gallons of wine. But he was very resourceful. He went to the local library, and there was nothing there. All the books about making wine had been pulled during Prohibition, and the library sent them into the basement saying, you might find something down there. And they found a couple of pamphlets that I think it was a professor from UC Berkeley had written, and that was enough to get them started. So he was just, again, I don't know that he had one mentor, but he was very resourceful, very curious, would always ask questions of people.
Smart, so, all the way around, a very smart guy.
Yeah.
How cool. Well then, my question that I'm gonna end with is gonna be, who were your mentors in life?
Most recently, I would have to say my husband, because I didn't ever plan to write a book or think I would write a book, and he was very encouraging. He's a writer, a screenwriter, and a novelist, and he helped me through this whole process as far as structuring the story, and I would give him pages, and he would be as encouraging as he could be. He could also be brutally honest and critical, and I couldn't have done it without his guidance and mentorship.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Talking about Ernest Gallo. It's been really interesting to hear, and I wish you great luck on your next project.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.